Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on September 14, 2014. First off, I'd like to think you're all coping and getting by with the incredible prices of everything and the basics, of course, in the stores. And I've told you for years to get Agenda 21 through, which is a Millennium Project, which is sustainability projects, all the same thing. That all your spending money, your free spending money, would go to bare essentials. And that's where you're getting pushed today, through the power of the purse, in other words. That's a big stick indeed. And quite a few years ago, I remember, right on the air, where the Federal Reserve Chairman had said that the plan for the next 10, 15 years or more would be inflation per year, per annum, so much per annum. And we're living through it as they do it, of course. In other words, they devalue your currency constantly. The currencies are all tied together through the World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, and the IMF. And we're run by bankers, of course. Not your local branch that run the corner, but the ones that you don't see, and often based in Switzerland and other places like that. But that was always the agenda, very old agenda, and they've pretty well accomplished the task. Money's an interesting thing in itself, and it's all run on a con, of course, because simple mathematics or arithmetic can be understood by anybody. So when it comes to making something into a science or complicating it, you know you're into a scam right off the bat. And that's exactly what it is. But I hope, too, that you're all managing to get by through all this weather modification. It's routine today. It's routine weather modification on a daily basis, standardized stuff, as we go through parts of countries that are frying, basically, and other places which are being flooded all the time with, the routine weather modification and the chemical spraying, which they like to call geoengineering. Sounds better. And, of course, we're all being geoengineered and bioengineered all the time, too, with the fallout from all of this. And never mind the costs of places like Ontario, where it's going to be very hard this year to find potatoes or any vegetables that haven't rotted in the fields since it's rained pretty well every day since the snow stopped last May, I think, and it melted about the 1st of June. But there's been no summer at all here in Ontario. It's been daily rain. You wouldn't believe it. And night, day and night of rain. Occasional break for an hour or two. And dull skies all the time. And last night, on the 13th of September, it hit the freezing mark on the temperature. So big frost and all the rest of it. I've never seen that before. But here we are. This is a new normal, and we're always going through new normals, which won't even be noticed by the media. They won't tell you anything, and the weather guys will say nothing about it either. And I've noticed, I've kept my own charts to do with the rainfalls and all the rest of it, and they're constantly lying about how much rain you get. It's quite interesting to live in this matrix system, isn't it? Most folk, mind you, will not think about it, so they go from their climate-controlled homes, to the climate-controlled vehicles, to the climate-controlled workplace, and then back again. They don't notice much at all. And if you ask anybody, they have no memory of last year, which was just a little bit better, not much, and the year before. And it all started in a big time, with the rain, that is, in Ontario, pretty badly, about 2008 or so. The big spraying of the skies started heavily in 1998, in Ontario at least, and across other parts of Canada at the same time. But I understand now, I get photographs from all over the world, and it's in all countries. China gets it now, Thailand's getting it, and it's done with agreements, international agreements at the top, from their bogus governments, or at least the ones that run them. And because the governments you see don't run them at all, they don't run the countries. The countries are all part and parcel of the international corporation business. They tell the governments what to put through, and at the top of that you have the big international banking system, which also owns the military-industrial complex and everything else underneath it, masses of companies underneath it, which they actually own outright. just go into Goldman Sachs, and I can remember quite a few years ago, there was an awfully good documentary before the crash came, the last crash came, and a guy was invited into an office, and he sat behind a computer. You weren't allowed to see the screen, but he saw the Goldman Sachs, and he says, "My God," and they owned all these big military companies underneath it. That produce all the weaponry across the planet. Quite the business. And last week I touched upon some of this weaponry in Rise of the Warrior Cop, a book by Radley Balko. Excellent book to read. I'll read some of it tonight to review it again, because there's so many points in it that it tells you, it gives you an in-depth look at why it's happening, how it's done, how the money's channeled to different states and little towns in the middle of nowhere by the federal government. And of course you have all the politicians on board, because they're all getting under the table cash, obviously, from the lobbyists to promote all this stuff, big sales and military equipment to police forces. But it isn't just the US, as I say, it's Britain, Canada, and other countries too. Australia's into it big time as well. So, and again, too, I really thought about this after last week's talk, because I thought about the whole idea. I remember reading years ago, articles from newspapers to do with, how would they maintain order in a peaceful world? Big international meetings about it. And they said, well, the future would turn to terrorism long before 9/11 happened. And therefore security equipment and anti-terrorism methods would have to be born, brought into existence, including basically a lot of more hardware for police, etc. Police would have to change their whole outlook on what they were there for, but also mainly the public would have to be trained to accept this new outlook as well, as though it was normal. But we've seen that with the masses and masses and masses of movies that came out and still are being churned out with budgets from the Pentagon and elsewhere. With the good-looking hero, of course, he always gets a blonde at the end, and he always gets the bad guys too, as he blasts his way with all kinds of heavy hardware through all the bad guys that seem to be everywhere. And the bad guys, remember, are all of you, the citizenry. And that's the sad part about it. You're being trained that this is normal, and you're being trained that you'll see it near you eventually as they go rampaging through streets and houses and everything else. It's very sad, but you're trained through an awful lot of fiction. Youngsters think it's fantastic because they like excitement, and they watch all these movies, lap them up. And in a very simplistic fashion, they want to be just like these robocops, in a sense, with all their gear on, with authority to go out and just shoot up the places and shoot up people and do that kind of thing. Authority really appeals to people who have no discipline. And that's another part I'll just briefly touch on tonight, because I remember reading about the communists, young communist party, and how the communists indoctrinated the young in the Soviet system. It's awfully interesting. And I also read on about the Nazi Party for the Hitler Youth. And it's very, very similar, because Hitler, of course, studied the Soviet system intensely, because the Soviet system was held up by the world before World War II. The whole world held up the Soviet system as a great new experiment. And Ross was to be fascinated by it. They didn't tell you about the massive slaughtering going on of civilians and a whole classes of people being wiped out by the millions, but they promoted, oh my goodness, how it pulled itself up from a peasant agricultural society into this great mechanized industrial society in no time at all. And you know, all the big magazines in the 20s into the 30s were promoting this wonder thing, and it was being well studied by the West, who was funding it all, of course, again through the big bankers, as was Adolf Hitler, in fact, being funded by them too. But Hitler copied it too, but he did talk about it. He and Hitler had mentioned the youth. He said, when you have a society where the parents lose their discipline over the children, he said, have a void. They have a lack, a real void. They want a discipline, an order, boundaries, in other words. And He said, when they suddenly come into the Hitler Youth, just like the young communists in the Soviet system, they get this respect for their teachers, their leaders, who take them out on the field trips and seem to be part of them, and it's adventurous and all that kind of thing. But they come to respect. So right away they give their will over to the leaders of the teams. And they're part of the team, the group. They lose your identity with the group. Just like joining a police force, same kind of thing. Or a military. But it's awfully interesting. And those children will grow up to be fanatics for the group and for the idealism that it projects, you see. Very, very interesting indeed. But these are all sciences that have always been known for an awful, awful, well, actually thousands of years by those who helped instruct governments. Advisors. Now, in such systems, those same youth are indoctrinated into shopping out or ratting out their parents if they're politically incorrect, or they hear them at the table or whatever saying something against the dominant regime. The children in the Nazi system would rat out their parents. Same in the Soviet system. If you did that, you were well rewarded. As well, you were really brought into the fold, made to feel that you were somebody special. And because of you'd already shown your allegiance, total allegiance to the state, to such an extent, you could get into the secret services and things like that. You could meet a part of the secret police, for instance, eventually trained for that, and you go into that. And then you could go into different branches of it, torturing, whatever it happened to be. And you had that ability to turn off any emotions completely and lose your emotions because you saw yourself as part of the team of us against them. And that goes with all militaries, that goes with all police forces, more so and more so today as they ramp up the anti-terror campaigns everywhere and the propaganda internally. And getting back to last week's talk, I talked about Rise of the Warrior Cop. Now, in Rise of the Warrior Cop, that's a very important part of the training of the policemen. A lot of these young guys coming in now are the generation brought up on video games that desensitized them to killing, for instance, and they have no problems of locking on a target and shooting at all. Before, it was very difficult. That's why these games were invented for the military, first of all, to try and desensitize the most. People are averse to shooting people they don't know. And that was always a problem with military in different wars. They did big studies in the Civil War, America Civil War, and they found around about 15% of the people actually had their rifles fired on the battlefield when they picked up the rifles from the dead and so on. It's not a normal thing to shoot people you don't know. And just other factors too. The more dissimilar they look to you, the easier it becomes to an extent, because it's easier to dehumanize someone who really looks very, very different. But you find too that this is a common enough thing. World War II, big studies again into how many folk would actually shoot at the enemy and kill them. And statistics were done. And then they worked hard after that, after World War II, to find ways to desensitize troops, and they came up with the idea of early video games to desensitize them, where you're into a game factor. The whole idea is to get from A to B or A to Z and just kill as many of these little things that come along your way. And that's how you start off, until the little things become more humanoid, until they are human looking completely, and you just shoot and kill. You have a generation bred specifically for today's ongoing perpetual war, and also to go into the military and into the police forces as well, especially in the US, and it's rising in Britain as well, big time, and it's going to cross the whole so-called civilized world. This is the agenda. And I thought about all of that, and I thought about too about a very good documentary that came out. It's called Camp 14, Total Control Zone. It was directed by Mark Weiss, and it was a German production, but it's done in English. And it's about a young guy, I think he's about 30 now, perhaps, but he was born inside a prison camp in North Korea. Camp 14, that was his world. That's all he knew was Camp 14. And what happened, I mean, it was all these simple rules, very simple rules. You don't talk to women or instant execution. You don't do this, don't steal food, instant execution. Don't, whatever it was always instant execution, which they actually did all the time. And they bring the whole camp out to witness executions to get the message across constantly over and over and over. But if you're a good worker at whatever you did, and this guy's dad apparently was a machinist with a lathe in the metal shop, because he was a good worker, he was given the privilege of having a wife, but he could only see her five times a year. However, over the years, she conceived two children, two boys, and it was quite interesting to see what happened there, because to us it's inconceivable. It's the stuff of fiction, really, isn't it, to people in the West. It's so out of their normal understanding. But this camp was brutal. All these camps were brutal for political prisoners. And to get into the camp, in fact, in this interview, this incredible documentary, it's got to be seen, Camp 14, Total Control Zone by Mark Weiss. The interview as well, one ex-guard who admitted to shooting people out of hand when he felt like it, and just picking women who came in and having sex with them. If they got pregnant, the camp guards got them pregnant, they'd get the women and they'd tie them up under trees and beat them until they died. There was just simply no retribution of any kind whatsoever. Brutality ran the whole system. And it's probably still going, that camp. But anyway, another one was a guy from the secret police who arrested people and put them in the camps too and shot them out of hand as well. He also defected eventually for a better life for himself, no doubt. I don't know if it was out of guilt or anything else, or he just simply wanted more of the better life. But these two people, the officer and the guard, were very candid about what they did to the prisoners. It was quite amazing to hear it. And rather than just simply condemn them out of hand, I looked at them, I watched them, studied them, and realized this can be done anywhere, in any country in the world. Believe it or not, it can be done in any country at all in the world. You better remember that. Never, ever, ever forget that. You know. Now, this young guy that the story's about, who gives an interview about it, you can see he's psychologically damaged big time. But he was born in it, in the camp. His name is Shin Dong Hyuk, or Hyuk, it's called, H-U-Y-K. And all he knew were the rules. Now, the rules were, again, that he must shop his parents if they were politically incorrect. His mum, he saw him all the time. The dad only came five times a year for one night. And mum had to shop the sons if they were incorrect. That was drummed into them. There was to be no emotion really shown there. He didn't know what love was. He didn't know what affection was. He had no feelings for his mother, really, or his brother. And he did really awful, awful jobs, including working in mines by the age of about 10 or so, or 12, coal mines and things. They froze pretty well in the winter. They were kept on a starvation diet, same diet day after day, year after year. And horrific, horrific conditions. What was interesting too, one of the guards said that it doesn't matter how much you beat them and so on, it's just that they didn't commit suicide. The resolution to survive becomes strong, just to survive. Because they're very simple rules, do this or we kill you. It was so simple. But eventually, at the age of 14, I think it was, his brother had run away from his plant. It was a massive camp, this, with barbed wire everywhere, literally electrified fencing. But the young brother had run away, and he he came back to his home, his mum, to ask advice, and she had put a little bit of grains of food by. She was packing it up, but Shin Dong-hyuk, the movie was about him, the documentary, he said that he was watching through the window. And what he did then was go and report, because he heard them say, he thought he heard his mother and the brother discussing getting out and running off away, getting out from the wire and getting away. So he went to report them. He felt nothing at the time either. You better remember that. This can be done anywhere, folks. But he reported them to his teacher. And the next thing he knew was he was lifted the next day and driven off blindfolded to the prison camp inside the big compound. And he was tortured and beaten severely, so badly that you'll see on the documentary. His arms are almost shaken. They eventually pulled him up to the roof, basically, with ropes tied to his wrists and to his ankles. They put hooks through him, and the scars are all on his body. One was even through the pubic area, and it ripped the skin and so on. They put fires underneath him, roasted them. His back is all scar tissue and so on. And apparently the teacher had not told them why. He just didn't like the child or something, and he just said that it was a bad child, go and punish him. But he didn't know that his father had also been lifted and was in a part of the camp as well. I mean, he was getting tortured too. And that went on for about, I think, 7 months. But you can't believe this until you hear it. And you can see the pain this guy trying to even talk about it. Fascinating story indeed. But eventually he was brought back to the camp, and some old guy in the prison, another prisoner, had managed to save him and patch him up best he could. I guess straighten out the bones to let him set as best he could. Then he was taken back to the camp, and that's when he saw his dad for the first time. He'd been in the camp as well. They were brought immediately to the front line of an execution, and the ones that were being executed were his mum and the brother. That's what they did, and they saw them being killed. He felt resentment at his mother for causing all of this, rather than, you know, he's too young to understand the circumstances. All he knew was his camp. This was his world. He didn't know there was any world outside of it. I mean, you can literally bring people up, and this is all there is. This is it. This is your world. Here's the rules. Follow them or we'll kill you. We'll beat you or kill you. Utter brutality. Utter brutality. No kindness shown, nothing shown. Kindness would be punished, that kind of thing. And eventually he goes through the story of how a newcomer came into the camp, told him about a world outside, and how he did barbecued chicken and things like that, and he couldn't imagine this, and the two of them tried to break out eventually through the electric wire. The newcomer went over, hit the wire first, got electrocuted, got killed, but the wire was pulled down his body. He crawled over the body, and he got his legs electrocuted crawling over. They're all scarred as well, because they were severely burned. And he got away eventually. He got into China. They sent him back to Seoul in South Korea. And from there, he was picked up. His story was picked up by reporters. And eventually they took him on a tour for some organizations. They're going about cruelty across the world. But you could tell this young guy will never, ever have anything that we could consider normal. His mind can't adapt to the modern world. What was interesting to me at the end was when he was talking about his soul. He said he wanted eventually to go back to where the camp is, or was, if it was, in other words, maybe down the road in future, to farm or something, just to be there. That was home. That was home to him. And he said the only time he had purity, it was kind of double speak, he kind of wanted to be in the camp to an extent. He said, I want the purity I had when I was in the camp, purity of the soul. And I think it'd be very difficult to get proper translation, but because it's an explanation given over in a voiceover in English. But I think what he was referring to was things were so simple. He mentioned that there were simple rules, a few of the simple rules, and you didn't have to do any thinking. And remember that immediately I thought of Charles Galton Darwin said in his book, The Next Million Years, the people won't need to do thinking. All their thinking will be done for them by the state. That's what's here now today, where you're given all your opinions. But anyway, he said that, this young guy said, he didn't have to do any thinking. He had no emotions either. Now he's got a burden of emotions because he didn't know what affection was before this. He didn't know that people could be kind or nice, and this is a new thing. It kind of shattered him. And he probably has some guilt too that he didn't survive, perhaps, and others. And plus, he thinks his dad probably was shot after they found out that he himself had escaped, Shandong, the son had escaped, and he probably shot the father. But a hellish existence. You don't hear much of this in the news as they tell you to start here hating Arabs because they make the women wear veils over their faces. So we can play left, right and centre by all the corruption that's going on and propaganda, scientific propaganda. But these camps are horrific, and this is the 21st century. Man doesn't advance at all. And believe you me, under the thin disguise that you have of civilization, you have the same people who will become the prison guards, the torturers. They're all there already. A lot of them are already in uniform. Doesn't take much. They know how to turn the switches on these guys and get them working into the next mode if they want to. We saw what happened with extraordinary rendition. It's happening all over the place, still happening. Where if we're just kidnapped from Canada or the US, wherever, whisked off to another country, tortured and so on. Lots of them never come back, by the way, because there's such a mess at the end. They can't let them go loose in the streets and tell them what happened to them. They kill them. So the West is doing just the same kind of thing, folks, using the same kind of torture techniques. And it's just horrific. We've already seen some things come out of camps. And we like to forget that because we've been taught to look at the positive side and ignore the negative side, the thing that makes us feel unpleasant. And unfortunately, that works with most folk awfully well. That's why nasty things eventually come upon you all. And that's why I come up with things like the Soviet story, another one you must watch, things like that, because you've got to understand there's no such thing as a human evolution as such. The propaganda they give us that somehow we're more civilized today, believe you me, is utter rubbish and nonsense. An interesting thing that this same young fella, this Korean, said, the Shindong Hyuk, he said that, because he's still lost, obviously, this young guy will always be lost between worlds, and he said that all we had to worry about in the camps was food, obeying the rules and having food to eat, because they never had enough. He said, but here, and he's talking about South Korea, he says, everyone talks about money, money, money. Same in the US and everywhere else, money, money, money. And they've got to have money to get the food and things like that. You could see his frustration as he's talking about this. To him, it seemed all crazy. And it is crazy because it's another form of slavery, whether you like it or not. That's what it is. You know, the people at the very top get awfully rich off your labor, as Marx said. And some of the things that Marx said simply were already understood by economists and the top economists and John Stuart Mill and all these guys. And it's true. All true wealth comes from labor, the production itself, those who make the things, not from the guys who simply have the cash to own the things or own the factories. Today, it's even worse than that. It's holding companies, own thousands of companies underneath them, and they don't even care about how their profits are coming in. They just tell the guys who own the companies, who run the companies, the CEOs, bring in more profits, and that's why everything you buy is garbage today. It's breakable junk garbage. We have cut corners to maximize every bit of profit. Nothing gets cheaper. It just gets cheaper made. That's all. And it's not meant to last. And eventually we'll get to the stage, and we're getting to it, by the way, where things that you buy are literally non-functioning when you're brand new, because it's made of junk. Mind you, they've also trained the public to accept junk, a gradual training process, until people literally think buying cheap plastic rubbish for vacuum cleaners or about half a vehicle, a car, a brand new car, with all its junky little cheap chips in it, it's all quite normal, and they'll pay a grand a time to get a new chip in here, there, everywhere. There's just chips everywhere. It's just incredible how they've trained the public to gradually, over a span of 40 years, to accept junk. But anyways, I say economics is another form of slavery. And Charles Galton Darwin, and his book, and other ones too, Russell's, all these boys, go into the same thing, that the power of the purse is very mighty, backed up with law, the coercion to obey and pay up this and pay up that for new fees, taxes, whatever it happens to be. And you can just jack up the prices of food, etc., and make it more difficult to survive buying meat. That's another thing too. This thing at Camp 14, meat was pretty well non-existent for them, except for the rats that they could catch in their little huts, and they'd cook them and eat them. That's all the protein they could get to hold. It's interesting to me to see the massive propaganda coming out today. With meat's going to be scarce for most folk in the future, and they mean most folk, not all of the big ones at the top, and the civil servants and bureaucrats and so on, or the cops or the military and so on, they'll get the meat all right. But for the peasantry, it's to be down to eating crickets and munched insects and all this rubbish. The BBC apparently just did a 3-part series on this to make sure you're getting an idea of how wonderful it'll be with all these proteins we'll have from all these different things that you wouldn't think of eating before. We're trained like, it's so darned easy, we're trained by our masters, aren't we? And you've always got the greenies, a generation of greenies born and brainwashed to be part of a movement to save the world, save the planet, to promote all. And although their leaders, mind you, will be eating plenty of meat at the top, I can guarantee you that. But the little, you know, airheads at the bottom will be dutifully eating their rice and their soya and all the rest of the junk without any protein. Now we'll get back to the war on drugs, as I say, which is, I knew a long time ago, many, many, many years ago, I knew it, that this was partly an excuse to create an internal army in the world, across the world. And remember, presidents and prime ministers don't say something like don't declare a war on anything. And unless they mean that as a war on something. Remember, wars often suspend rights, constitutions, things like that. And this is the reason for it. This is part of the reason for it. But you must get some kind of excuse for getting a massive internal army built up. Because down the road, and they knew back in the days of Nixon when he started up the FEMA bunch and so on, they knew. And because they work on behalf of the masters, and we above them, as they went to globalism and economies went down and all the rest of it, they'd have eventual riots down the road. And they want internal armies to deal with it. But what would they use them for in the meantime? That's an acceptable excuse. Well, a war on drugs would do. Now, I've done talks on the radio, on different radio shows, on the farce of the drugs, because you have the CIA came out with and the Pentagon came out with Oliver North, Colonel Oliver North, during the inquiries into the drugs for guns scandal that came out there, where they were literally arming other rebel groups and so on with guns in Latin America, but they were doing it in exchange. The currency they were using was from another country, and they were getting basically heroin and so on and drugs and selling it on the streets of America for their black budgets to American children to buy these guns to give to their basically so-called rebel forces in Latin America and elsewhere in the world. This is still going on today, folks. It hasn't stopped. But I also read another article by an ex-Special Forces guy who gave a fantastic interview in a newspaper, how he bumped into another ex-Forces guy who was helping run the drugs into America. Well, this particular guy who was writing the column, or was the column was about, was in the Coast Guard trying to stop drugs coming in. So here's two ex-Forces guys, one with the Coast Guard, one helping run the drugs in for the CIA into the US, and they met up in some little exotic place and exchanged occupations, basically. Anyway, the guy who exposed in the paper, the Coast Guard guy, he eventually was killed, of course. And that's what happens in real life. So in other words, the war on drugs is something to use the cops on, with, you know, a reason to recruit more and more, to militarize them and give them all these heavy military equipments. At the same time, the Pentagon and your tax money is putting out movies, exciting movies for the young, especially, but adults watch them as well. And always against terrorism, to get you to make you think that it's so necessary now that we have all this massive internal militarization of police forces. And Britain's the same way as well. So it's training the public on that score as well. But first you must need a reason for having them, and so they used a war on drugs, which are being shipped in. The biggest lots are being shipped down by your own country or your own governments that are way above them. But here's getting back to this book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, and it says here, the 2000s, a whole new war. It says, Betty Taylor still remembers the night it all hit her. As a child, Taylor had always been taught that police officers were the good guys. Of course, she's seen all the movies and everything else too, and all the dramas and television. She learned to respect law enforcement, as she puts it, all the time, all the way. She went on to become a cop because she wanted to help people. They all say that. And say Boy Scouts, you know, they want to help ladies across the road and stuff like that. And it says, and that's what cops did. She wanted to fight sexual assault, particularly predators who take advantage of children. To go into law enforcement to become one of the good guys seemed like the best way to accomplish that. By the late 1990s, she'd risen to the rank of detective in the Sheriff's Department of Lincoln County, Missouri, a sparsely populated farming community about an hour northwest of St. Louis. She eventually started a sex crimes unit within the department, but it was a small department with a tight budget. She couldn't get the money she needed. She forced to give speeches and write her own proposals to keep her program operating. What troubled her was, well, the sex crimes unit had to find funding on its own. The SWAT team was always flush with cash. The SWAT team, the drug guys, they always had money. Taylor said they were always state and federal grants for drug raids. There was always funding through asset forfeiture. That's a big part of it, by the way, because they copied this from the Soviet system. I hope you understand that. Everything's happening in the US and Britain and elsewhere, it was all copied from the Soviet system. The cops who would raid people's homes would steal everything in the place, and they could put it up for auction, but they split it amongst themselves usually and help fund their own departments as well. So it was very lucrative to them to do as many raids as possible, same as it is in the States. But it said here that they always had money, and they got all the big grants from the federal grants and so on, and the state. There was funding through asset forfeiture. Taylor never understood that disparity. When you think about the collateral effects of a sex crime, of how it can affect entire family, entire community, it didn't make any sense. The drug users weren't really harming anyone but themselves. Even the dealers, she found much of the time, were just people with little money just trying to get by. And she said the SWAT team eventually co-opted her as a member. As the only woman in the department, she was asked to go along on drug raids in the event there was any children inside. The perimeter team would go in first. They'd throw all of the adults on the floor until they had secured the building, sometimes the children too. And by the way, they put gun cell at the heads of the children as well, but that's the standard in all countries now. And it said then they'd put the children in a room by themselves, and the search team would go in. They'd come to me, point to where the children were, and say, you deal with them. Taylor would then stay with the children until family services arrived, at which point they'd be placed with a relative. And generally they'd whisk them off to the homes now, of course, that's big money too. Tira's moment of clarity came during a raid on an autumn evening, November 2000. Narcotics investigators had made controlled drug by a few hours earlier. So there was a sting operation and were laying plans to raid the suspect's home. The drug buy was in town, not at the home, Tira says, but they'd always raid the house anyway. They could never just arrest the guy on the street, which of course they could, but they never did it. And they always had to kick down doors, like kicking doors. But just 3 hours between the drug buy and the raid, the police hadn't done much surveillance at all. SWAT team would often avoid raiding the house if they knew there were children inside, but Tira was troubled by how little effort they put into working out or finding out that kind of information. 3 hours is nowhere near enough time to investigate the suspect to find out who might be inside the house. The afternoon that the police had bought drugs from the stepfather of two children, ages 8 and 6, both were in the house at the time of the raid. The stepfather wasn't. They did their thing, Tira says, everybody on the floor, guns and yelling. Then they put the two children in the bedroom, did their search, and then sent me to take care of the children. Made her way inside to see them. When she opened the door, the 8-year-old girl assumed a defense posture, putting herself between Taylor and her little brother. She looked at Taylor and said, half fearful, half angry, what are you going to do to us? Taylor was shattered. Here I come in with all my SWAT gear on, like Darth Vader, you know, dressed in armor from head to toe, and this little girl looks up at me, and her only thought is to defend her little brother, I thought. How can we be the good guys when we come into the house looking like this, screaming and pointing guns at the people they love? How can we be the good guys when a little girl looks upon me and wants to fight me? And for what? What were we accomplishing with all of this? Absolutely nothing. Tira was later appointed police chief of the small town of Winsfield, Missouri. Winfield was too small for its own SWAT team, even in the 2000s, but Tira said she'd have quit before she ever created one. Good policing work has nothing to do with dressing up in black and breaking into houses in the middle of the night. By the way, it's the same thing they do world over. That's what the Stasi did in East Germany. That's what they do in North Korea. You hear the guards talking about it, busting in the middle of the night. And it says, it's breaking into the house in the middle of the night. And the men, mentality changes when they put on the SWAT team, when they put on their gear. I remember a guy I was good friends with, it just completely changed him. The us versus them mentality takes over. You see that mentality in regular patrol officers too, but it's much, much worse in the SWAT program. They're more concerned with drugs than they are with innocent bystanders, because when you get into that mentality, there are no innocent people. It's really us against them. Them's all of you, the whole population out there. You're special. You're in your Darth Vader suit and all your armor. You're black, you're menacing. You're covered, your gear's always black and menacing. It says there's us and there's the enemy. Children and dogs are always the easiest casualties because they can't fight back, right? Quite something. But it's so sad. It's so sad what's been allowed to happen. And this book too, by the way, you got to get this book because it was through so many of the botched raids where they were using informants who simply made up the stories on people, and they would do dozens and dozens of raids, regardless if the informant was lying, and they'd bust and smash up all these houses, dozens and dozens of them, some of these teams, before they'd eventually get rid of that particular informer. There was one sad case where they busted into someone's home, it was the wrong address. That happens often too, especially when they have maybe 10 raids that night to do. I mean, this is how much what they accomplish. You know, you understand, when you create any government bureaucracy, they must start to feel, it might get their importance up there, or they might get disbanded. It doesn't matter what they start up for. And as bureaucracies are the same, and they must expand and expand and expand to show their bosses how important and necessary they are. So they create more work than you can believe. But there was one botched one, as I say, and they came in, threw the guy on the floor, middle of the night, threw the child on the floor, 11-year-old boy, and put guns to their heads and all the rest of it, and I think the guy's wife was there too, all had guns to their head, and the one that was holding the little boy on the floor, who wasn't moving, fired his shotgun, point blank hit the guy's, the boy's head, blew his head off. This is happening across civilized countries, and you've been taught that it's normal. There was no drugs here. It was a mistake, wrong address, the whole bit, which it happens frequently. Now, the senators all know this in the US, but they're all for this program because their bosses above them tell them. Plus, they're getting big money from the lobby groups, from the military-industrial complex to sell all the tanks and everything else they're getting there. The heavy military equipment. Because as I said earlier on, years ago they said what they're going to do when they run out of wars. Well, they would start long beforehand, before they run out of wars, preparing for internal terrorism to sell equipment to the governments. And they've been doing it through cons like this. And there's massive federal funding. Anyway, it says by the mid-1990s, the Byrne Grant, B-Y-R-N-E grant program, Congress had started in 1988, had pushed police departments across the country to prioritizing drug crimes over other investigations. When applying for grants, departments are awarded for with funding for statistics such as the number of overall arrests, the number of warrants served, or the number of drug seizures. Those priorities then are passed down to police officers themselves and are reflected in how they are evaluated, reviewed, and promoted. Perversely, actual success in reducing crime is generally not rewarded with federal money on the presumption that the money ought to go where it's needed. Almost need high crime areas. So the grants reward police departments for making lots of easy arrests, that is, low-level drug offenders, and lots of seizures regardless of size, and for serving lots of warrants. When it comes to tapping into federal funds, whether any of that actually reduces crime or makes the community safer is irrelevant, and in fact, successfully fighting crime could hurt a department's ability to rake in federal money. Money, money, money. It all comes down to money, doesn't it, eh? But the most harmful product of the Byrne Grant program may be its creation of hundreds of regional and multi-jurisdictional narcotics task forces. That term, narcotics task force, pops up frequently in the case of studies and horror stories throughout this book. There's a reason for that. While the Reagan and Bush administration had set up a number of drug task forces in border zones, the Byrne Grant program established similar task forces all across the country. They seem particularly likely to pop up in rural areas that didn't yet have a paramilitary police team, what few were left. The task forces are staffed with local cops drawn from the police agencies in the jurisdictions where the task force operates. Some squads loosely report to a state law enforcement agency, but oversight tends to be minimal to non-existent. Because their funding comes from federal government and whatever asset forfeiture proceeds they reap from their investigations, local officials can't even control them by cutting their budget. This organizational structure makes some task forces virtually unaccountable and certainly not accountable to any public official in the region they cover. As a result, we have roving squads of drug cops loaded with SWAT gear who get more money if they conduct more raids, make more arrests and seize more property, and they're virtually immune to accountability if they get out of line. In 2009, the Justice Department attempted a cost-benefit analysis of these task forces, but couldn't even get to the point of crunching the numbers. The task forces weren't producing any numbers to crunch. Not only were data insufficient to estimate what task forces accomplished, the report read, data were inadequate to even tell the task forces did what they did for routine work. Not surprisingly, the proliferation of heavily armed task forces that have little accountability and are rewarded for making lots of busts has resulted in some abuse. It's quite amazing, really. One of the most notorious scandals involving the task forces came in the form of a massive drug sting in the town of Tulia, Texas, July 23, 1999. Task Force donned black ski mask caps and full SWAT gear to conduct a series of coordinated pre-dawn raids across Tulia. By 4 a.m., 40 black people, 10% of Tulia's black population, and 6 whites were in handcuffs. The Tulia Sentinel declared, "We do not like these scumbags doing business in our town. They are a cancer in our community. It's time to give them a major dose of chemotherapy behind bars." The paper followed up with the headline, "Tulia's streets cleared of garbage." The raids were based on the investigation work of Tom Coleman, a sort of freelance cop who, it would later be revealed, had simply invented drug transactions that had never occurred. They don't investigate their own crooks within their departments. The first trials resulted in convictions based entirely on the credibility of Tom Coleman. The defendants received long sentences for those who were arrested but still awaiting trial. Plea bargains that let them avoid prison time began to look attractive, even if they were innocent. Coleman was even named Texas Lawman of the Year. But there were some curious details about the raids. For such a large drug bust, the task force hadn't recovered any actual drugs, or any weapons for that matter. And it wasn't for a lack of looking. The task force cops had all but destroyed the interior of the homes they raided. Then some cases started falling apart. One woman Coleman claimed sold him drugs could prove she was in Oklahoma City at the time. Coleman had described another woman as 6 months pregnant, and she wasn't. Another suspect could prove he was at work during the alleged drug sale. By 2004, nearly all of the 46 suspects were either cleared or pardoned by Texas Governor Rick Perry. The jurisdictions the task force served eventually settled a lawsuit with the defendants for $6 million. In 2005, Coleman was convicted of perjury. He received 10 years of probation and was fined $7,500. This shows you the rackets involved. And these are the characters who are making up stories for their to get their paychecks. And they just don't care who they pick for it, really. Easy targets, I guess. And another page here, it says here, really interesting, it says, the heavy-handed federal enforcement on medical providers wasn't limited to marijuana, because we're doing medical marijuana. The states were putting it through as legal for treating people with severe pain. But the state ones that were going in and raiding and still arresting the folk who were getting licenses from the different states, independent states, you see. As fears about prescription opioid painkillers started to take root in the media in the early 2000s, the professionals with medical degrees, practices, offices, and patients singled out for allegedly over-prescribing a certain class of drugs. There's still a debate over whether over-prescribing these drugs, as defined by drug cops, not other doctors, should even be a crime, and whereas some of the doctors were even over-prescribing in the first place. Those questions aside, it's hard to fathom why it would be necessary to send SWAT teams to storm their homes and offices, subjecting their families and patients to the violence and volatility of a typical raid. But it's true, they're using these teams now for everything, you understand now. You just don't send a policeman to the door to ask a few questions. No, you just send in the teams, smash everyone up and make a big scene. It's just like the movies, you see. And we like movies, don't we? Now, here's a little part here too. It says, we're going to have our own tank. Keene in New Hampshire Mayor Kendall Lane whispered to Councilman Mitch Greenwald during December 2011 City Council meeting. Going to have our own tank. Wow. It wasn't quite a tank, but the quaint town of 23,000 people, home to just two murderers since 1999, had just accepted $285,933 a grant from the Department of Homeland Security. Now that's your tax money, folks, to purchase a Bearcat, which is an 8-ton armored personnel vehicle made by Lenco Industries, Inc. Since the September 11 attacks, Homeland Security has been handing out anti-terrorism grants like parade candy, giving cities and towns across the country funds to buy military-grade armored vehicles, guns, armor, aircraft and other equipment. Companies like Lenco have thrived, creating yet another class of government hardware contractors and a new interest group to lobby Washington to ensure the process of police militarization continues. It says here that the Department of Homeland Security grants have dwarfed the 1033 program. At the end of 2011, the Center for Investigative Reporting found that Homeland Security had given out at least $34 billion in anti-terror grants since its inception, many of which went to such unlikely terrorism targets as Fargo, North Dakota, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and Canyon County, Idaho. Defense contractors that had previously served the Pentagon exclusively, CIA reported, have since shifted their focus to police departments, hoping to tap a new Homeland Security market bounty expected to be worth $19 billion annually by 2014. Police, as they'd done with the 1033 program, they'd initially argue that the equipment was necessary just in case they had school shootings or whatever. But in Keene, there was some resistance to the Bearcat. It began with one guy, and they go through the story and so on. And they got their bear cat and all the rest of it, with all of its, is packed with all kinds of fancy hardware. I think it's even got a 50 cal on it, machine gun as well. But this is for policing, folks. You wake up, hey? Anyway, it says this Mike Clark, 27-year-old handyman Clark, who had a couple of encounters with the Keene police, said that this, he described it as a negative thing. And read about the Homeland Security grants in the newspaper. The police are already pretty brutal, he says. And he says the last thing we need is this big piece of military equipment to make them think they're soldiers. And that's the problem, folks. They put these things on and really feel that they're soldiers now. It's intentional, too. The big boys at the top know what they're doing here. And it says they had various town meetings to see if they should use the money for to do better policing, you know, amongst the public, as opposed to militarizing them like this, et cetera, et cetera. But, however, the military bunch always seems to win out, because this big money changes hands, probably down to even mayors and all the rest of it, too, I'm sure. That's just my opinion, but that's what happens in real life, folks. But it says here that it's a line of argument defenders of militarization use often. Oppose the arming of cops as if they were soldiers, and you must secretly want cops to be killed on the job. That's one of the excuses they'll give. But the video Lenko was using to market the vehicle to police departments didn't exactly emphasize negotiation. This is how the advert, just like the military, they actually have ads specifically for cops, you see. And it says the camera viewpoint in the video was similar to that of a shooter video game. The soundtrack was AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Cops dressed in camouflage toted assault weapons, piled in and out of the Bearcat, and took aim at targets from around and behind the vehicle. They then attached a battering ram to the front of the vehicle, which then used to punch a hole in the front door of a house, into which they injected canisters of tear gas. This is the ad. This is the company, Lenko, wasn't stupid. Chosen images and music used in the video because they felt it would appeal to those police departments in the market for a Bearcat. Dori O'Meara, 13-year-old resident of the town, told me Keene is a beautiful place. It's gorgeous and it's safe. We love it here. We just don't want to live in the kind of place where there's an armoured personnel carrier parked outside a city hall. It's just not who we are. According to the CIR's research, the Department of Homeland Security gave out $2 billion in grants in 2011, about four times the value of equipment given out through the 1033 program. As with the Burn Cops grants, the DHS grant program also got a big boost in President Obama's 2009 economic recovery package. He really put more into it, massive more, because he knows what's coming up down in the future and why they really want all these internal police, which are military. The CIR investigation also found that DHS makes little effort to track how the grants are spent once they've been sent, nor does it track the equipment, how it's used once it's been purchased. And believe you, there's an awful lot of corruption in amongst the police forces too. Oh, yeah. So the agency doesn't seem to care if the recipients of the grants are places that face any tangible threat or terrorism. That's what it tells you, it's for a different reason, it's still to come. Hence, a city like Fargo, North Dakota, has been able to get its hands on an $8 million in grants, which the police department had used to buy assault rifles, Kevlar helmets, and an armored truck with a rotating turret. Fargo Police Lieutenant Ross Rare attempted to defend the city's armament. It's foolish not to be cognizant of the threats out there, he said, whether it's New York, Los Angeles, or Fargo. But until the day when the next Muhammad Atta casts Richfield's eyes on North Dakota, the department hasn't made much use of its gun-fitted armored truck. It's reported it's used mostly for show, this truck now, including the annual city picnic where police parked it near the Children's Bounty Castle. Or Bouncy Castle. But it's just astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. There's a story here too, which is kind of comical. It says here that in Maine, in Augusta, Maine, where there's fewer than 20,000 people, where an officer hasn't died from gunfire in the line of duty in more than 125 years, police bought $1,500 tactical vests. In Des Moines, Iowa, police bought $280,000 bomb disarming robots. They all want the toys, you see. And it says, while an Arizona sheriff is now the proud owner of a surplus Army tank, Montgomery County, Texas, the sheriff's department owns a $300,000 pilotless surveillance drone like those used to hunt down al-Qaeda terrorists in the remote tribal regions of Pakistan and Afghanistan. A couple of months before the CIA report, the sheriff in Montgomery County had broached the possibility of arming his drone with rubber bullets or possibly tear gas. I remember when that was in the paper. And it says, no matter what we do in law enforcement, somebody's going to question it, but we're going to do the right thing. And I can assure you of that, he said. 5 months later, the department made headlines when its Department of Homeland Security funded drone accidentally crashed into its Department of Homeland Security funded Bearcat. And these guys are going to expertly raid your home, and no one's going to get slaughtered, eh? Anyway, the point of what I'm getting across here is that there's a different reason why all this is being promoted. It trains the cops as well, that they're now a military. It doesn't matter if the cops even believe it's for drugs or not. It doesn't matter. They're a military, and you're all the enemy, and they're going to all be turned loose with all their heavy military equipment. If there's ever any real riots coming down the pike with the massive inflation, the next bank crash, or whatever else comes along, you're going to really see why they're really there. And just like I mentioned with that Camp 14 total control zone, you'll find that system can be brought on awfully rapidly. The torturers are all there waiting for the jobs, believe you me, if they're not already in some. And there's no difference to what can be done in North Korea and in your own country. As I say, your own people, whether it's Britain or wherever it happens to be, are doing the extraordinary rendition. And they're whisking people off and torturing them in exactly the same way as they get tortured in total control zone. And they slaughter the people as well at the end of it, rather than have them loose on the streets and getting sued over it. So just kill them. Very simple. That's civilization as we know it, because under the guise of our wonderful system, it's as brutal as ever. It's simply more clever in how it makes you perceive the whole system, folks. It's more and more clever. But you can see it got reverting right back to open the raw grossness of it all in a very short time, if need be. Believe you me. Sad, sad, sad. Human nature hasn't changed. Really hasn't changed at all. And there's no shortage of folk who'll do the slaughtering and for the government, and slaughtering and torturing in any country on this planet. Any country on this planet, folks. There's no shortage of the people who'll do that, and they get into the mindset, and they'll convince themselves as they're doing it, it's their right to do it. These people are scum for speaking out against the system or whatever it happens to be, and that's what they use for excuses. It's sad, isn't it? Sad that it's so easy to program people. It's terribly sad. As I say, remember that movie and the documentary came out from the prison experiment, Stanford prison experiment, and the movies that made the control factor. You become your job when you put on the uniform. Doesn't matter what job you're in, you become that darn job. But you put them into a uniform of authority, and the person literally changes their whole personality. It goes to their head. That's why police should never be dressing and behaving as military address and behave. Military are created to go out there and kill people. That's their job, folks. That's their job. That's it. And do you really want that, walking around your streets and busting your homes in the middle of the night, as they're doing, and it's all over the states now? And as I say, you've got to get the book Rise of the Warrior Cop, because believe you me, you just look at the front picture on the page there, and this is like something out of Star Wars. I knew when Star Wars came out, I said, this is for the future. I didn't see it till years later because I didn't want to see it in the first place, but it's pure propaganda, and you're programmed through the movies, of course, for what's to come. And it's here. Unfortunately, it's here, isn't it? And we get entertained into oblivion through indoctrination, through fiction. Youngsters want to be the guys dressed up like Robocop. you don't have to go searching to find people who will do this or search for torture. They're there, folks. Sad, isn't it? Now, remember, too, you're going to make good use of cuttingthroughthematrix.com. I've mentioned other good videos over the years that have come out from the ex-Soviet system to show how their system worked and what happened and the atrocities that happened there. You've got to understand this and know it all. Remember, too, you've been trained to avoid pain and seek pleasure. You have been trained deliberately to allow all this to happen. You have been trained. And if you can't, I can understand, for instance, Camp 14, a lot of folk will be unable to listen to this guy talking. It's definitely not an act with them. And a lot of folk won't want to hear it. So you probably heard that yourselves, I'm sure, if you discuss things with your friends. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. It's too unpleasant, you see. So, yeah, you know, unfortunately, to really, if you only want truth, very few folk want real truth, you know. They want a sanitized version of something that will suit their personality and their psyche. That's not what truth is. It's like gravity. It doesn't care what you want. It just is. So if you really want truth, you've got to look at the dark side of everything too. Because only that way can you ever possibly prevent it all happening again and again and again. And at least you'll see it coming. But I have to say that humanity has not progressed at all. We live under illusions, in a world of illusions, where it's been forced to work for nothing by slave masters in a camp, or forced to work for a system in which you have no choice at all, or you starve to death for something called money that's run by people you'll never meet, who decide its value every day, who decide that you're going to be trained to believe in it because they give the grants out and tell the school systems, the standardized school systems, what they teach you and brainwash you with. Your reality is given by them too. Save up. What's the point of saving up money when it's going to be worth a fraction of what it was when you put it in the bank? Fraction. Rate inflation. Everyone's a racket, folks. Anyway, you can help me out. Remember, buy the books and discs at cuttingthroughthematrix.com, or you can donate to me as well. You can find out how to do it at cuttingthroughthematrix.com or alanwattsentinel.eu, and help me tick along, because it's really murder here right now. I say there's been no winter, no summer at all. It's all winter. And seeing the sun is a rarity. I've only seen it a couple of times, two or three times this year. And now I've already got at night, it's now the freezing temperatures already, which is unheard of. But we know what's to do with their chem spraying and or as they call it, geoengineering, which is this routine weather control now. It's routine, daily routine. We live in illusions, and we don't want to see the bad side of things. They say the naive are the first to go, isn't, don't they? They crack up because they can't handle the bad news when bad actually really happens. They live in the Disneyland. That's it. They choose it, in fact. But it's up to you where you want to be. Remember, as I say, you send me a few pennies here and there. Help me to get by here. And I live a lot lower standard than most of you out there. And it's my own fault. I do this by choice. I wanted to come out and really wake people up. A lot of talk show hosts have made stacks of videos using my stuff and the material. So at least I've changed the way the whole thing was going quite a few years back, and brought more information on the table, which has to be discussed now. From Hamish, myself, from Ontario, Canada, it's good night, and may your God or your gods go with you.